This is Moss Whelan and Story in Mind. And what is your name?
Hi, I'm Nathan Ogloff, and I'm the author of the Sapien Empire series of books.
And could you briefly tell us what the series is about, genre?
It is a post-apocalyptic / dystopian story where civilization is making a comeback.
Fantastic. And too succinct, short and succinct. And using the hero's journey as a pattern, that those sort of four quadrants, we're starting off in the ordinary world, things before publishing, you as a reader, and can you remember sort of, say, what was there always post-apocalyptic stuff that you were interested in, or is this more sort of a new thing?
I would say it's more of a new thing. To give you a bit of a long-winded answer, I thought I was going to be an architect or an engineer when I was really young. Then I saw Star Wars and was like, architecture or engineering? Yeah, screw that. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make rich, intricate worlds that people can just dive into and get blown away from. So there was a focus on that. But post-apocalyptic specifically was because I had and this story in particular was because I had an idea in my head for a while of, it's really a synthesis of two ideas. So the first idea is realizing what post-apocalyptic is, which is it's our collapse of a society. But collapses have happened before in history, right? So the Middle Ages, from the perspective of the Romans, was their post-apocalyptic. The collapse in the 1100s BC by the Sea People, from the perspective of the Phoenicians, was their post-apocalyptic. So post-apocalyptic has happened before. Something always comes back. So I kind of wanted to focus on, hey, let's focus on something coming back. So that's the first idea. The second idea came about from a lot of the sad events I see in the world and the UN's complete lack of action to do anything about it, which is kind of what they were designed to do. So sometimes you see something, sometimes nothing happens, and it breaks your heart, and you think like, wow, I really wish there was just some entity that just took charge, took matters into their own hand, and went and did something about that. So I said to myself, well, hey, wait a minute. What if, as civilization's coming back, they say, you know what, we're going to do it right this time. We're not going to repeat any of the mistakes of the past. We're going to, this is what it means to build a better world. And so I started from there, and it just snowballed. It's been snowballing ever since.
I'm just thinking back to, say, first time or sort of early times seeing Star Wars, you know, the young architect seeing Star Wars. Do you remember, how was it? Was it sort of, say, Was it videotapes? Was it like DVDs? Was it like actually movie theaters?
I think it was just made for TV. Or not gonna happen. It was just on TV seeing it, and then oh, there we go. And then I think after that, it was around 1997 that they had released a special edition. I saw that in theaters, and that was like, I'm in. I'm so invested. I remember as soon as that came out on VHS, I'm going to get that. And I actually still have the VHS to this day, although I have nothing to play it on. So, sorry, what was the question? Like, oh yeah, that was my experience. So like, it was like a bit of TV, just knowing it existed. But like, I think seeing it in theaters in 97 was really what just like catapulted me forward.
I'm just remembering that, because there is a sort of difference. I've met filmmakers, people say studying film, people actively say, you know, working in television, and for me there's a bit of a contrast, and two for you, like, say, well, why not go that direction? Why not go film? What is it about writing that's attracting you versus that?
Okay, so a little bit of history about me. I didn't think I was going to do this until 2013. I thought I wanted to work in the video game industry.
Ooh, cool.
But those dreams died. I lost my passion for it. And I've also actually made a film before. But the problem with... So film and video games, you got to work long hours and you're away from your house a lot. And I've also noticed that the problem with that is you spend a lot of time not doing the creative aspect of it. So like an example with film is if you have a scene in a coffee if you have a scene in a coffee shop, it's like, okay, we have this scene in a coffee shop where they're talking. Well, then here's the logistics of it. Well, first you have to have a scouting manager find the coffee shop. Then you got to figure out where you're going to park the trucks, run the cables, set up craft catering. You got to set up the cameras. You got to make sure the lighting's right. And then you do several takes where it's like, oh, okay, are we ready? Are we, okay, wait, hold on. Maybe we just get that, like, okay, great, action. And then they do it for like 5, like 10 seconds. It's like, okay, great. Okay, now let's set up. Like, and by that point, I'm just bored. Whereas with writing, you just, like, I mean, we're in a coffee shop right now. So you just imagine, like, here's the shop. Here's what it looks like. Here's the dialogue that's said. Here's the series of actions that they're thinking about and the steps that lead from here to there. And then you write it and that's it. I mean, there's editing and going over it. But in terms of actual, like, writing, I don't do more than 4 hours a day, which John Grisham advises you don't, as opposed to the, what, like 16-hour film days? Yeah, screw that. And there's also a purity to the medium of book storytelling. Everyone can sort of play out the movie or the camera, quote unquote, in their head. And so it becomes a lot more personalized for that. And I notice a lot of books will stand the test of time. I remember reading Brave New World recently, but if I didn't know it was from the 1930s, I could easily play out something very modern in my head. And so I like that aspect too, knowing that I can potentially create something that stands the test of time regardless of whatever mediums arise and fall and exist in the far future.
Jumping back to the ordinary world and just say, being kind of like set, almost like set in stone or trapped in amber in a way. Do you encounter anything, or have you encountered, say, people or situations where, you know, people are saying, you know, oh, this is a bad idea, or, you know, are you sure you want to sort of get into the quagmire or swamp rather than seeing, you know, that this is a, you know, this is creative, fulfilling venture?
Yes, I had a cousin once not discourage me, but almost sort of imply that I was living in a realm of illusion, and that, like, there's a lot of writers out there, there's a lot of competition, there's a lot of great people. That doesn't mean it isn't guaranteed success. You should think of a backup plan and think about your future. So not discouraging me, but not exactly like rallying me on. There are a lot of other instances of people saying, like, what if it doesn't work out? What are you going to do for money? Isn't it tough to do that? What about your livelihood and your future and stuff like that? And all I can really say is, my response would be, what did you do last night after work? And most people will say, like, oh, I started watching this series on Netflix. Oh, okay. How was the drive home? It was great. Did you listen to the radio? Yeah, I listened to, you know, like, see the Fox or Jack F it, whatever. Okay. What'd you do on the weekend? Oh, you know, my family went to a movie and then watched something else on Netflix. Huh, interesting. Sounds like you kind of like art and like people coming up with new art as opposed to just recycling the same stuff that already exists and just not creating anything new. Sounds like you kind of want us around. There's that, and I find this path to just be necessary as opposed to let's just do this because, see, why not? I suck at the working world. This is what I was always meant to do.
Fantastic. Yeah, and because I've thought about that. It's like, say, well, it's sort of like, say, the ordinary world set up for, you know, certain things, and there are these artistic occupations, and there is creativity in every type of work. But then all of a sudden, there's this calling and saying, you know, oh. Or even just to try it, like, say, I don't know if you have ever gotten into music, but I can remember friends just sort of grabbing me and saying, you know, let's try this, let's go on stage, let's make some noise, see what happens. So, speaking of which, on social media, on Twitter, you posted something to me, and you used an animated GIF of from a Mad Max movie. Was that ever in your scope as far as, like, say, were you deeply entrenched in that, or was that sort of more from a distance?
Sorry, do you mean entrenched in post-apocalyptic or entrenched in helping people out and supporting others?
See. Yeah. No, I was sort of more, you know, like, say, growing up. I just remember seeing Mad Max movies and sort of, wow, that's an option. I could, you know, I could be a road warrior. How about you?
I was familiar with Mad Max. I was familiar with post-apocalyptic. I remember Kevin Costner comes to example because he did Waterworld and The Postman. So those are some post-apocalyptic. But I guess also for me, because I have this obsession with space and getting us into space, whenever I saw a post-apocalyptic, it was like the furthest we could get away from that. So it just kind of, in the back of my hand, it drove me to be like, want to pull them forward and pull them towards space. So, I mean, I guess that's kind of what's going on right here with me, is like, you're taking a society and people that are just absolutely broken and beaten down. Humanity's hit rock bottom, and it's like, okay, let's get you back up from there. Let's begin the process of renewing you. It wasn't so much post-apocalyptic, although it was there. But there was something a little intriguing about knowledge lost and people looking at our society, again, the way we look at ancient ruins from the distant past. It was just really intricate, detailed worlds. I like the Star Wars, I like Star Trek, I like Dune. Lord of the Rings, I remember seeing that for the first time, it just blew me away. So it's those really, like, you can tell the author poured their heart and soul into it. It's not a thriller where it's just, you spend 3 months writing it, you forget it, you go into something else, you come back, you edit it, you put it out in a year, and then that's done. This is on a completely different level, if you ask me.
So it's more, it sounds like, say, deep work, where, like, rather than the surface, there's things going on, but then, say, underneath, that is it that, say, you're being drawn to that, like, sort of a deeper kind of work,
and I guess you can say works that deal with subjects or relevant themes in our world on a much deeper level.
Fantastic. And just slowly shifting into, like, if this was the hero's journey, crossing the threshold and going into the underworld of publishing. And just sort of, like, say, a setup. For you on the outside of publishing, is it sort of, like, say, is it becoming more complicated as you look at it? Or do you sort of, say, have a clear view? What exactly is your, say, perspective at, say, I guess, going forward?
Publishing sucks. to put it bluntly and summarize it quickly, I've quickly found out that the publishing world today is not like it was 20 years ago. I think the problem is there's a lot of, I know there's AI generated books, which is an issue, but you can easily, it's not that great of a stretch to sort of verify who they're coming from. But I think also what it is with the internet and a lot of freeware platforms and social media platforms, and free resources available out there, it really lowers the bar for everyone. And when the bar gets lowered, as we saw with the iPhone, and they're going back to my video game examples, a lot of these companies would release, like, these free frameworks to make video games and easily deployed on their platforms. Well, again, when it's free and it's available and the bar is lowered, you get flooded with people, and so the app stores would get flooded with, like, these games that most didn't sell. And so it's kind of the same way with the publishing industry today. They're just so flooded and inundated with people that they get to make a lot of what you or me would think of as, like, ridiculous rules. So there's things like, well, to make sure you're not a risk, they want to see that you have good book sales first before they take you on. I'm sorry, aren't I kind of going to you guys to do that for me? Isn't that kind of your job? You encounter a lot of chicken and egg problems in this industry. Also, I don't know if I should really comment on this, but this is a theory of mine, but I don't know if they're looking at the actual quality of the work so much as the person. So there's a lot of, I think, woke ideology that's starting to factor into it, which, to be honest, I think anybody who's an artist or an author out there, they want people to see the work, not just take yawn because of these superficial qualities that don't necessarily dictate what you're writing. I mean, you know, black, white, green, gray, got a hump on your back, got some weird physical deformity, it really shouldn't matter. An author that I talked to a couple years ago, he said all that really matters is the text, or at least it should be, and I really agree with him. So this is a bit of the opinion piece of me. I can't really verify this, but that's the nature of the publishing industry nowadays. So I was trying to find a literary agent for a year. I sent out maybe 40 or 50 query letters. No one took me on. I also heard that hold on, I've lost my train of thought. I heard that most literary agents, best if you just meet them in person, and you can usually do that at writing festivals, which unfortunately means you have to go out and find them. Sometimes you might have to spend money to pay for a ticket to go and fly to another city. There's that, but it was, for me personally, in June, I met a marketing person who convinced me to go the self-publishing route. She had some really convincing argument and really good things to say, and she's given me a lot of guidance, and so I've done that, and so that is a route that's increasingly accessible to people nowadays. And I know there's going to be a lot of aspiring, young, blossoming artists out there listening to me going, can I swear on this? I won't go crazy with it, no?
A little.
Okay, well, no, it's fine. I'm not going to go crazy. There's a lot of young artists that might be like, what? Oh, screw that. No way. I was the exact same way, but eventually I faced the music and I realized, well, how badly do I want this? Is this a hump or a hurdle I'm willing to go over? And I said yes, and so for me personally, it's I say the nature of the industry almost pretty much forces you to go self-publishing nowadays.
Right. I'm just as we're now in the underworld of publishing, but like say if this was a screenplay, we'd be sort of moving upward. Things are getting, you know, it's optimistic and positive. And heading towards the release day, the book launch, is that something that you're sort of planning out meticulously? Like, say, do you have a strategy, or is it something that is still developing?
This is the strategy, Moss being right here. But this is part of it. It's if anybody wants to know what marketing is, it's basically just, I call it an advanced form of networking. It's getting you connected to other people. So I'm now connected to Moss's audience. Hopefully, if you're listening to me, you will want to go and get the ARC and go pre-order the book, which comes on pre-order on Tuesday. Yep, that's right. The strategy is I post on social media every day. I post relevant information. I post stuff that if you're into post-apocalyptic and science fiction, you're going to love. I definitely recommend checking me out. I interact with other people online, just commenting on their content, reaching out to other podcasts, interacting with them first. They don't just feel like I just want to get on their podcast and that's it.
Is it okay to ask about, say, the design, say, design layout? Is that something that you're tackling by yourself? Do you have other people involved in that?
No. This marketing person has been fabulous for helping me with that. She's told me to do all this. She's told me, here's like some of the hashtags you can use. Here's how you can sort of make these posts a little better. We meet every second Thursday. To talk about what I'm doing and refining it. She's really been good at giving me guidance and letting me know what I'm doing right and what I'm doing wrong. So I do definitely have help, and she works with her fiance in the same company, and so one of the pieces of advice her fiance said was, imagine you had to go to court and defend yourself. Now, what are most people going to do? They're going to hire a lawyer. But imagine you said, I don't want to pay the money for a lawyer. I'm going to just go do legal research myself and defend myself. How well do you think you're going to do? Is there a chance you're going to win? Yeah, sure. But you can tell just from this example, most of us are like, you're going to fail. You're going to like lose your case. Well, it's the same thing with marketing. There's people that go to school for 4 years to get a degree in marketing. So the idea of I do research myself and I just figure it out and it works out, a little unrealistic. So I'm glad I'm working with them. There's also just reach. I have a Facebook page I recently set up. I have a TikTok account I post videos on every now and again.
Will you be doing like
A live? Will you do a live book launch? Like, is there a place where you'll have like, say, physical books or online?
Or both? Yes. February 6th is when the book comes out. I will be doing an Instagram live stream with two other authors that are also on. They're going to be on Instagram too. I plan next year on going to When Words Collide and hopefully selling my book in person. It will be available for paperback and ebook once it's out. So the question was...
Oh, the book launch. Like, say, so you're going to have some form of book launch. And even these days, I've been wondering about, well... Is it worth having a physical book launch? Is it, you know, say, it could be anywhere, you know, at home, a party, like almost like a birthday party, you know, hey, here's the new baby.
Yeah, so I do plan on having a launch party just with people that I know and just as a celebration of here's this endeavor that I started over 10 years ago and it's now finally coming to fruition. Congratulations on... winning the game of patience. Yeah, I will be doing that, definitely. And then after that, it's just reaching out to more podcasts. Eventually, I'm going to want to put the first draft of the second novel up for beta read, just to get feedback from people. And let people know that the second novel is coming out next November 2024. And just continue what I'm doing right now, really, just a wider reaching more people. Just doing all the strategies I have, social media, reaching out to podcasts. I'm doing a book reading December 12th. Again, it's just an advanced form of networking. You're trying to get yourself connected to as many people as possible and let them know in a fairly succinct way as possible what you're about and what you're selling and why they should buy it.
Yeah, it's networking. Old school networking and then new school networking. One question I had, I sort of said this up earlier and I'd mentioned it had to do with, say, series. It's sort of like, say, that you've committed yourself to doing a certain amount, which I like, but a question is there, why not a standalone? And in a weird way, the standalone has this focus, but say, what was it that drew you to doing 8 books?
This was actually supposed to be a standalone, one book, and then it became 2, then 4, then 8, but given the scope of what I'm doing, I think that's understandable. So that's why I'm committed to an 8 book series, just because it was originally going to be a 1 book series, which doesn't make sense. But yeah, and if I've been at it for 9-10 years and I'm not tired yet, then I don't think I'm going to get tired. So that's the answer to that question.
I'm still playing around with post-apocalyptic, say genre wise, because there are a lot of options. Mixes. I'm just wanting to sort of get at what exactly is behind the choice. You probably mentioned it before, but I'm still stuck on it. I just like sort of say talking about genre, and the specifics of it. The setting. So where exactly is this set?
It actually takes place here in the Pacific Northwest. And I chose the Pacific Northwest just because I know the area. I know the micro details of the terrain, and those are very vital in the beginning when they're setting up and rebuilding and the initial stages of the rebuild. So it starts here and it just spreads out over the course of the series. And if you want to know why post-apocalypse, there's something quite chilling and interesting about. So there's two types of post-apocalypse. There's one where, like, you think like Walking Dead and The Last of Us. It's really, it's the people that exist in the story have knowledge of what the world was like before the collapse, and now they're kind of dealing with the, like, the crap that's going on. And then there's another type of post-apocalyptic where the event that caused the collapse is so far back in time that it's steeped in legend and there's nobody around who remembers it. So if you think like Mad Max, Waterworld, what's another good example? The time machine, briefly, when they talk about the Eloi, that's another example. Yeah, there's something like that. So there's some, the reason it's interesting is because, A, you see our world, the way, like, we see the Romans, or, again, like, ancient ruins of civilizations that are no longer here. B, there's something interesting about, because sometimes they'll take something very mundane or benign that has, like, really nothing special, and it becomes elevated to, like, a religious state. So if you think, like, Mad Max Fury Road, the cult of V8, it's just a steering wheel, but it's, like, it's become so significant that it's, like, their religion. And, like, a V8 engine is just, it's, like, it's just an engine where the camshafts are in a V configuration, but it's become, like, this, like, elevated thing. So I'm, like, that's kind of interesting. You kind of saw the same thing with Waterworld when Dennis Hopper's character, their god is like Captain James, and it's just like the captain of the tanker, and that's it. He wasn't like anyone special. There's that, and then it's just, it's the whole concept of knowledge lost. We know stuff they don't. There's a certain simplicity to it too, because I think it taps into our default form of organization, which is these small hunter-gatherer bands, which in a lot of post-apocalyptic, that's really what the societies are. Yeah, so it's just like, I guess you could say I have a fascination with it, in terms of how I have a fascination with, like, science fiction, like Star Trek. It's all about societies, and societies that either exist or societies that have collapsed. You want to say, you want to chime in and take it?
And just chiming in on, say, well, we're both in this area, and it's sort of like, say, it feels almost like it's what we have, and it's almost like, say, you say, and now I'm going to take it away, right? And this is a potential. This is sort of like I'm showing this is what it could be like, right? And it's underneath, it's got this realism. It's connecting to reality, and it's almost sort of branching off. There is a possibility things could go that way. Earlier you were mentioning, say, us going to the moon, going to the Mars. And I think it just said the Mars, but yeah.
Mars, the Mars, whatever.
Yes.
We all know what we mean.
And to sort of taking these different paths, is that something, like, are you, how firmly are you based in, say, the reality of now versus, say, what you're expanding on and going off into? Do you do, say, like, references to, oh, we were going to go to Mars, but, you know, that isn't going to happen? Or, say, political scenes, things used to be, you know, here's the structure that used to exist? Or is it, say, that it's moved on so completely that it's kind of been wiped off the map?
Sorry, I understand the question. What's been wiped off the map?
Yeah, that's a very vast question. That, say, where we are now, like, say, how much of the past, I guess, still exists or is known?
We know of the past, but also there's, like, certain ways of living in the past that are not very well known to us now. So, I mean, you'll hear my dad talk about, like, they used a slide rule in school. And when you don't have, like, computer technology, there's a certain way you have to, like, structure your life. So it's like paying a bill. You can't just auto withdraw it. You got to kind of like take a paper stub and go to the actual place. So it's there's always a way of life from before that we no longer know of and have, and some people might say it's not useful. I think it has some merit to it. We're considered more advanced, but now we're kind of getting into this area that I call like my science fiction across, not up. So like, to give you an idea of what I mean, they're trying to figure out how they got the pyramid blocks so straight. They're like, how did they do it? Because they didn't have machines, they didn't have lasers to do it, right? Well, they find out like it's pretty straightforward. You get a plane of water, and then you chip the stone onto that along that line, because the water is always going to be flat. If you want to cut down, you just get a rock and a rope and you hang it down. It's always going to point down. So that's how you get your right angles, and that's how you cut it. But the reason we couldn't think of that is because that's a different line of thinking that we no longer need, and so it's passed on. So when I say across, I mean we have that line of thinking in addition to like whatever line of thinking we have right now with the technology we have, right? So it's like we're taking into account all the strata of our history into how we approach problems and maybe how we think about how to go about making things, for example. I don't know if I'm getting off topic or off the question.
That's good.
Yeah, so with that being said, are we going... I have issues with the education system and a lot of what kids are being taught nowadays. I don't think they are getting fully prepared for the future. What is it? Oh, there's like, okay, so here's the funny example, just because I know it. So one thing that's not being taught was in Stranger Things in season 4, there was a dark room, which for you youngins is where they used to process film on actual photographs, right? So I knew what it was, but some of the younger viewers were like, I don't understand what the red room is. What's the red room? And it's just because they've grown up with digital phones and media all the time. And sometimes they don't know what it means when an adult says, hang up the phone. Because you don't hang it up, you just press the end call. But like, what you guys don't know is we used to have these phones on walls, and the receiver would hang on a cord, and you had to physically hang it to end the call. So...
hang it up?
You know, I was just listening to a podcast with Bill Maher, his Club Random podcast, and he's talking about, he talks to young people nowadays, and he just feels like they really know nothing. So, I think this is a very roundabout way of saying it, but I think there are some issues of concern in my society. I think there are issues that show signs of decay in our sociological structure and our... intellectual makeup that are I would definitely like to see fixed for sure.
This is, I believe, we're moving into we're into the crisis quadrant,
the third act.
Yes, and however you divide it up, we're in the sort of like the downhill, the crisis section. And one of the things I thought of for that is, you're talking about networking, and for me, I'm quite removed from reviews, but there's others who are, and too, I'm sort of hearing about it every day. Sometimes people will have like a full-on meltdown because of a review, and because some of the reviews are just scathing, awful, like really mean, and then other times, you know, there's sort of, oh, I just got this great review, right? And so this weird sort of relationship. I'm just thinking too of a writer who's been around here in Vancouver a long time, and they them getting like in fights, and not physical fights, but you know, arguments. With reviewers about the reviews. So crisis, a response, you're getting, like, say, There's going to be great things. There's going to be great reviews. But say, how are you going to be dealing with not great reviews? How are you going to be dealing with parts of the network that are the social networking that are just awful?
I'm going to curl into a ball and cry. It's I don't know if you saw that internet meme, which was, it used to be like they'd show something sad, and then it was like this diagram of a guy saying, "Lie down, try not to cry, cry a lot." So I think I have to answer your question with the question: are these like just some random reviewer, or is it like a reviewer this person sought out, said, "Please review it," and then they gave an honest, the reviewer gave an honest review, and then the author was like, "That's not what I wanted," and then that's where the argument snowballed from there.
It's quite the mix. One of the reviewers I'm thinking of, they do honest reviews, but they're not pulling any punches. I think even in their profile they say that, saying, you know, I'm not pulling any punches. And for me, let's say, I'm not going to read these for myself. I'm not there for that. I'm not doing that. And I'll watch some writers who have an amazing support team. Like, they're surrounded by this support, right? You know, just go, 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 right? They've got cheerleaders. It's amazing. And yeah, say, for you, is that something that you would surround yourself with? Or is it sort of like, no, you know, I can do this on my own. I don't require that.
I think you need to surround yourself by two types of people. You need the people that are going to cheer you on and say, yay, go, make it happen. It's going to be a hit. You're going to be the best author ever. I have so much hope in you. And then you need other people that are a little bit more grounded in reality and say, okay, this is what you need to do. You need to edit this novel. You need to go to these channels to do marketing so that people get attracted to you. This scene's not working. You need people grounded in reality. But I also wanted to touch up on, you're kind of asking this in a roundabout way, but you said, how do I deal with negative reviews? Well, I learned a long time ago, I'm not going to make everyone happy. Plus, 1,000 reviews and each of them is 5 out of 5. That's a little unrealistic for anybody to expect. So I am expecting some people to not like it. I think it's good to have people that like it say good things first. So I've had my mom, but it's my mom, read it, and she likes it, but she also doesn't normally read science fiction.
Right, yeah.
I've had another author who does romance read it, and she liked it. I had a friend of mine do a very extensive review. The review is like a page and a half long, or 2 pages. He liked it. So knowing that, okay, I can make a good story, that's good. So anybody else saying something, it's just not their cup of tea. I mean, you take any story that people like. I mean, you take like Star Wars. There's people like me that absolutely love it and dived into it. There are people out there, it's just not for them. They just don't get it. And that's fine. I think also what helps is to, before you put your book out there, so I don't know about your author buddies that have gotten into arguments, I think it helps when you make the book, you get feedback first, work on that, and then when you realize I can only iterate so much before I get it out there, you just, you finish it. So an example was, I had an author who read the beginning of my story, and his response was, I read the story, I thought we were going to have another meeting for this. It's not, I hate to say it, but it's just not there. There is just really nothing happening. And I'll admit, I got a little upset at him, because I was like, you write thrillers, and you said you don't understand science fiction. What the hell? But check your ego at the door, because you're not the next New York Times bestseller. You're not necessarily going to be one of the greats. I think it helps to have the occasional slice of humble pie. But I got other people saying the exact same thing as him, so I did change the beginning, and the beginning is what you guys will see when you read the book. So, yeah, like I said, that's how I deal with negative reviews. I take it on the chin. I realized also a long time ago, people don't have what I call the quote-unquote answer. So this applies to just life advice in general. If someone's like, well, you know, the stock market's really up right now, and I heard IPC's got some really, it's on the rise. I think that was a good time to invest. I mean, it's a good future if you ask me. Well, that person thinks he knows what's best for you, and he may not necessarily, or she, whatever, may not necessarily be correct. So, you know, like, a lot of people think they know more than they actually do, that they got the answer for you, and 9 times out of 10, they don't. So, how do I deal with negative reviews? Well, it's just my general attitude towards people in life.
Riffing off of this, I'm reminded of working with an agent, developing a project, to use the terminology, and looking back on it, many requests, you know, could you change this, could you change that, title, et cetera, et cetera. And ultimately, my book, you know, it wasn't accepted. And I sort of went, this is weird, you know, she's sort of doing all of these things, you know, sort of to the best of your ability. So I'm wondering for you if there are, if it's sort of at what point do you sort of stop and say, no, I'm not going to make changes. I suppose too, it's difficult because you have to get there. You have to sort of be in that position and be willing to make those changes. But say for you, do you have, and even say with beta readers, and say you're getting all of this advice, and maybe it's good advice, but it's not your book. Which way would you go? Would you sort of like, okay, I will go with all of this. This is great. And yeah.
Well, I'm self-published, so I can write and put out there whatever the hell I want. But to be a little less curt about it, in terms of reader feedback. So in terms of reader feedback, I will change something if multiple readers, almost all of them, are saying the same thing about a particular scene. If they're like, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense, it's vague.
So you are listening.
So, oh yeah, of course I'm listening. So at that point, I'll change. In terms of agents or publishers in the far future, if I happen to get one, I sometimes just know the areas where I'm like, it has to have this. This is very critical and important. This has to stay. So I won't budge on that.
Right.
But there are areas where I'm like, they want me to change this? Sure. This has to go? No problem. Because I think in that scenario, it is, in order to get anywhere, you do have to compromise. You do have to know when to pick your battles. And you have to know when it's okay to, there's going to be differences, but sometimes you have to meet people in the middle ground, and so that's a necessary evil sometimes.
I think you said you're a plotter, like you know, you'll plan a lot and get things going, and one of the difficulties I've heard from plotters and all writers is that say there's this resistance. It's weird. It's sort of like, say, characters will refuse. And I'm getting a shaking the head. It's like, nope, they do what I say. But let's see. Have you encountered anything while you're working on it which has tripped you up in the sense like that where there's this resistance or characters? Or is it for you, is it sort of like this, you know, it's just go?
I don't know what the hell that means when they say characters are refusing to do what you want them to do. You're the god of your own world, and when God tells somebody what to do, they do it. I think it's just that, again, that's probably just the way that person is. It's just the way things flow for them. It doesn't really flow for me that way. I think it's partly because I gravitate towards science fiction, because science fiction is about situations and ideas rather than a heavy focus on people. So that's just what happens to work for me. And I plot, but the plot's really meant to be just a broad guideline for where I'm supposed to go. It's not set in stone. So sometimes I'll find this scene's not working out, I need to add a scene here, this needs to go. But for the most part, it's been working fine so far. I've actually plotted out my second novel before I even started writing it. It's working out so far. I will admit sometimes I come across a scene where I'm like, what am I going to write here, or why does this exist? But I figure it out. I even plot scenes, like here's the step-by-step process or motions through which the scene goes. And the only time I really pants is when I have to come up with dialogue or description. Like, it tends to, like, just... Sometimes I'll find, like, oh, I can make it flow this way and that way just by following this series of steps. Sometimes there's difficulty in making the dialogue link or match up, but I always manage to make it work. So, again, it depends on the person. Some people, I guess, you can say plotter, pantser, it's a spectrum. Some people are heavy pantsers. You have people that are plotters, but sometimes things get pantsed along the way. And then there's me, where, like, I'm very heavy plotter focused.
Yeah, I have that, where it's a mix. There's, you know, heavy structure here, but, you know, here it's more sort of open, flexible, organic. We're now in the last quarter of this, the return to the ordinary world. And let's see. My thought was, and too, I was curious, work, so, or rather writing and life balance. And for you, let's see, what kind of things do you do outside of writing that are kind of like, that are not writing?
Well, I give myself the rest when I need it. I'm very mindful of the wants and needs of my body and mind. Outside of writing, I play video games. I'll go and walk. I'm actually part of a Spanish-English language interchange. But one of the more fascinating aspects is I make spaceships in Lego Studio.
Awesome.
And I use Lego Studio because I don't have the space or the parts to make them in real life.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah, because one of... I don't know if you mentioned it, but it was... And you'd mentioned sort of, I think it was like 4 hours. Was it Grisham that said 4 hours writing and sort of that's good enough? And I've heard people say almost like page counts, like aiming for a page count and then, you know, that's it. You know, get out, do something else.
It depends on the person. I mean, you'll have people that write 500 words a day and they're like, that's fine. You'll have people that write 5,000 words a day and they do it for hours and that's them. It really just depends on the person. I mean, it's quality over quantity. There are quantity people, there are quality people. I tend to be more quality. Just like John Grisham, I find that after 4 hours, it really gets more difficult for me. I mean, I sometimes will go a little bit over 4 hours, just if I know I'm done, almost done with the scene. But, again, depends on the person. There are people that can put out 6 books a year. There are people that can only put out 1 book every 2 or 4 years. It's you just do what's natural to you. Don't force it or else you're just not going to be happy. And if you're not happy doing this, what's the point? You might as well go get a quote-unquote normal job like everyone else.
I really like that you've got a series because it's this commitment and it's sort of to keep going. But eventually that series, you know, that will come to an end. And I almost don't want to ask about a plan B because I don't want to be that person. And yet I have already put that forward. Because it, say for me, publishing to some degree and then returning sort of like, almost like waking up and going, oh, it's over. And, you know, the next project has started. And then, you know, climbing that mountain. And to just sort of say, thinking about you, thinking about continuing, and planning, is it sort of like, say, is the plan locked in, where it's sort of like you have a very crystal clear plan, or say, you know, after book 8, it's just kind of like, you know, an unknown of like what happens beyond that, or are you just going to sort of like, you know, you have future books planned out for beyond that?
Okay, so when you say plan B, do you mean after this series or if writing doesn't work out?
Well, let's see. Plan B in the sense of sort of like, you know, some sort of there's all sorts of things that can be sort of put next to writing. Like say some people will go and they'll be, say, teach writing, right? Or something like that. And so Plan B could be, it's sort of like a bit of an open book, right? Some, like, say, I'll talk with some people and they'll go, you know, oh, well, I have these other projects. I have these other things that I want to do, like, say, I don't know, scuba diving. Or is it, say, I just have this sort of notion of sort of like that you're locked in and you're committed and, you know, there's no stopping, there's no looking back.
So I'll answer your question in two parts. So the first answer is the manic desperation answer I give myself sometimes when I'm in certain moods is, there is no plan B. I have to do this. This is necessary. There's no other option for me. It has to work out. But what if it doesn't work out, Nathan? No, it has to work out. It might not work. It has to work out. So just getting really, like, angry about it.
Right.
I'll say this. If writing doesn't work out, I've actually had moments in which I was, like, heavily facing that as a reality. So what I did was I thought about what else can I do. And so I went online and I typed in how to become a pilot. And then also I type in, is there an age in which you're too old to be a pilot? To the point that I said, okay, I'm going to download Microsoft Flight Simulator, just get a feel with this. And I still, like, play that now and again. So, I mean, that's, if anything, a plan B. Almost to the point that I was like, I really hope this writing doesn't work out so I can be a pilot. But obviously that's not the case right now. So there's that. And then asking you, like, what do I do after this series? Well, I've already planned the series. So I have another series of just, like, three books. Of potentially just a bunch of, it's really just like a collection of short stories that I'm going to write. And then after that, there's another series. And the reason I say after that is because they're all canon within this universe and they just take place at further and further dates in the future. And that's science fiction. And then I do have an idea for a fantasy series I may or may not get around to that I want to write. If anything, I might just come up with the world and offload it to someone and say, hey, just take this and run with it. But yes, those are my far future plans and goals. I think at one point, if for some reason I just ran out of juice and couldn't come up with anything, I would just tour around. I'd go to conventions, I'd introduce myself, I'd have Q&As, people come up to me. I'd really just pass the torch, so to speak, just be the source of inspiration that inspired me to do this, and just do that to somebody else, make somebody else go, man, I want to do what he does. I want to make that happen. And then they, again, pass the torch. They get their own momentum going. And I'd really like to help them with that. So those are my goals.
And two, I wanted to say that the book is happening. The book is going to happen. And so that's on the way. And it's more sort of like, say, my experience of not happening quite the way I thought, right? And sort of lowering the bar, but still going forward, still working on the thing, and getting a greater appreciation for the craft and just how nuanced it is. Really, it can be taken anywhere. So, people can meet you at conventions. That's something afterwards?
It depends on what happens. I mean, if I'm so well known that people are inviting me to go and talk, like, I'll do it. But at the moment, it's really just going to writing festivals and conventions and putting my name out there. And I really want to be on some panels for When Words Collide in next year, in 2024. That's a plan, but I don't know what's going to happen. We could all be dead tomorrow. A coronal mass ejection of the sun could happen next year, and suddenly we're all out of work because electronic stuff doesn't work anymore.
There's your science fiction reality. Let's see. So we're finishing up here. 7 minutes to go in the ordinary world, and it does sound like you've got a great support, which was nice to hear about your mom, and then say a couple of other people, and it sounds like that's enough, like, to have these people, you know, they've got your back. And is
Is there anything else, sort of, say, that in your arsenal? Is there sort of like, is there other groups, other people that, or say, areas like, say, things that you go to that where you sort of find motivation or support, just sort of personally to just sort of move forward?
Well, I would just say going to some of the stories I like and worlds I like diving into. It's helpful talking with other authors and readers and having people just constantly tell me, like, your book seems interesting, it seems like something I'd like to read. Being around those people that just kind of put wind in your sails.
Yeah.
And also just giving myself time in the day to just sort of like pause and think and just assess just the current chapter that I'm moving into of my life and how I'm finally getting to do what I've wanted to do for the longest time. And just putting things into reality, just understanding that, hey, you've got a good life, regardless of how this goes. And by every definition of the word, by what a lot of people would say, you are a winning, quote unquote, life. That's really all I can say.
One thing I think about, like, say, from my own experiences, like, say, doing this, like, say, it's not exactly the way I thought, but I don't regret the doing of it. Like, say, the accomplishment, making the book, that, say, it's interesting, too, our sort of society and our culture, the values that we put on a book and publishing and being an author. And let's see, wrapping things up here, and to going back to that, because like say you're making something that could inspire in the same way that you were inspired, and is that a thought while you're working, like, say, you know, you're crafting, you're editing, is that something, sort of, does that concern you, or is it more sort of that you're I'm not going to be worried about that, how this is received by that, you know, that person?
I know enough at this point about what I'm writing to know I've got a style that's unique enough and that I got a story that's good enough to actually do that. What I'm thinking when I'm in the middle of it is just I'm writing what I want to read, and that's what's making me happy, and I think this is intriguing enough. And if you write what you want to read, there's enough people out there that are also going to want to read it, but they couldn't write it because either they don't know how to write, or they don't have the time, or they're not in a situation to do it. So I guess you can say, like, there's sometimes this, like, oh, I think people are going to like this, I think this is going to blow people away. Because let's be honest, when you're pursuing this professionally, that is part of the reason you're doing it. So I do have those thoughts that come about, mixed in with thoughts of, like, this is just what I want to do. This is just me currently in the world, in the story world, and I'm just describing what's going on in the story world as I write.
And your name again is?
Nathan Ogloff, and I am the author of the Sapien Empire series of books, which the first one comes out next February, second one in November, and then November 2025 is the third one, November 2026 is the fourth one.
It's so good that there's a plan, because I'm sort of like going, I don't know, after this I have no idea, so I'm kind of inspired. I might sort of head home and start mapping things out. Yes, what will happen after this? Anyways, thank you very much.
Yeah, of course.